This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us.
I have a new guest on Church and Culture today. Dr. Michael New is well known among pro-life Catholics. He is an associate professor of economics at Ave Maria University, a Phi Beta Kappa grad from Dartmouth, and received master's and doctorate in political science and statistics from Stanford. Dr. New researches and writes about the social science of pro-life issues, and he gives presentations everywhere, it seems, on both the positive impact of pro-life laws and the gains in public support for the pro-life position. He's frequently seen as a blogger on National Review's online The Corner. Michael New, welcome to Church and Culture.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
Now, before we talk about the statistics of abortion, could you explain to our listeners just what is the Guttmacher Institute, and you know, how long have they been around, and how reliable are they in reporting abortion statistics?
Sure. The Guttmacher Institute, I think, was founded in the late 1960s, I think 1968. Up until about 10 years ago, they were the official research arm of Planned Parenthood. And they have kind of technically disaffiliated themselves, but I still think they get some donations and grant money from Planned Parenthood. And, you know, they're a research arm that supports legal abortion. And, there are some people there that, you know, do some, you know, decent research on some issues. But their PR team always has a very kind of pro-aggressive, pro-abortion spin. That sometimes, when it's true with a lot of studies, you need to read the actual study to find what the researcher is saying. You shouldn't believe the spin put on that study by the PR shop. So, again, they're very pro-abortion, they're very pro-contraception. They don't like to acknowledge that anything that pro-lifers do is positive. And I know that, for instance, last summer they did a study on declining teen pregnancy rates. And all they talked about was contraception. And in reality, there's very good data for both National Survey of Family Growth and the Youth Risk Behavior Survey indicating significant declines in teen sexual activity. And they didn't bother to mention this.
Well, let me ask you this, though, before we go on to sort of chronicle some of the more recent spin on, and really, as you put it, cherry-picking of statistics. Are there any other reliable sources for abortion statistics, or do you have to kind of put it together yourself like you do in your research?
Yeah, I think by and large you kind of have to put it together yourself. The Center for Disease Control also does release some statistics, and there are states that release statistics as well. Unfortunately, it's kind of a patchwork. There really are not very strong federal rules about abortion reporting. I think that you know, pro-lifers, in fairness, probably should have made this some more of a priority at one point. I think that political capital is limited and our resources are limited, and we didn't really put a lot of time or effort or energy into getting better reporting laws. So the CDC does report data, but it's of mixed quality that, again, many states don't report. I shouldn't say many, but some states don't report. For instance, California has not reported any data to the CDC since 1997. So I think that tells you something.
Well, would the Guttmacher Institute report include data from California?
Yeah, when Guttmacher does reports on abortion numbers, they do a survey of abortion facilities. So I imagine that abortion facilities trust Guttmacher, and I think they're probably willing to give them information.
Wouldn't there have been a time when Guttmacher would have been delighted to find as high a number of abortions as possible in order to make Planned Parenthood look good?
It's hard to really say how reliable the figures are. I mean, to be honest, they really want to show that they really have a really pro-abortion, pro-contraception take on things. But I will say that the data from the CDC and the data from Guttmacher tend to track each other pretty closely. Essentially that the trends are similar. Obviously, the CDC data is not as comprehensive, but you see pretty similar trend lines in both data sets. So I think that I wish we had better data, but we have what we have.
Well, done a great job in keeping a kind of watch over the data, and especially that of the Guttmacher Institute. In fact, recently, only a week ago, on National Review Online, on the corner in your column, you responded to a study released on global abortion rates by Guttmacher. It covers 193 countries, six territories between 2010-2014. And you found a fundamental flaw in those studies. Tell our listeners about that.
Right. We see studies like this come out pretty often, that there are groups out there that try to collect data on abortion rates by country throughout the globe. There was a study like this in the British medical journal, The Lancet. I think they've done two studies like this since 2010. And Guttmacher had a study that came out just this year. And what they often find is they find that abortion rates are similar in countries regardless of whether or not abortion is legal or illegal. And the spin they give is that pro-life laws don't matter, abortions will happen anyway, and frankly, it's better to legalize abortion because that will ensure that abortions are done by trained professionals in medical settings. But this is a very, very flawed and incorrect conclusion to reach. The main problem with this is that they're not comparing similar countries. If you look at countries around the world, most of the countries where abortion is illegal are located in Africa, South America, Latin America, or the Middle East. These countries tend to have very high poverty rates. They have other, social pathologies that may increase the demand for abortion. And you just can't compare these developing countries, which are often very poor, to industrialized democracies like France or Switzerland. So, you have to try to compare similar countries. And we do know.
Well, Michael, let me interrupt and ask one question that jumps out at me. If it's so hard to get data, how are they getting data from undeveloped countries in Africa and South America?
Yeah, that's another issue as well. I mean, if abortion's illegal, we can't really get necessarily accurate data from those countries. And I think that Guttmacher, their analysts, have made mistakes in the past. One thing, kind of circling back to your earlier point, they have an incentive to kind of, I'd say, misrepresent the data from a lot of these developing countries because they're interested in contraception and funding for contraception programs. If they can say that these developing countries have high abortion rates, they can make a case to try to get more funding for these contraceptive programs. So, essentially, there are some legitimate concerns about the reliability and quality of data they get from these developing countries. But the most important thing is they're comparing apples to oranges. Again, you can't really compare, very poor countries in Africa and South America to, again, industrialized democracies in North America and Europe.
Now, the fundamental reason for that is that the abortions done in the undeveloped countries where they are illegal are simply that they don't follow the rule of law. Is that the reason why it's apples and oranges?
It's just apples and oranges, just because again these countries have again much higher poverty rates. For one thing, and again, they just have possibly higher crime rates. They have higher, there's other instances of social pathologies that may increase the perceived or the actual demand for abortion. Again, you just can't necessarily do cross-country comparisons. When you look at the countries that do have good legal protection for the unborn, you do see lower abortion rates. even incremental laws in the in the United States. We have good data showing that, you know, public funding restrictions that, prevent taxpayer dollars from paying for abortion, parental involvement laws. Again, there's a very good, very broad, set of data and studies showing these incremental laws do in fact reduce, abortion rates.
But they are trying to show that laws against abortion do not lessen the number of abortions that are done, while the legality of abortion doesn't make the numbers necessarily grow. They're trying to show that passing laws against abortion really doesn't do the job of lowering the abortion rate. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. But they basically try very hard to downplay the impact of any kind of law, and they try to, frankly, play up contraception, you know, which I think is misguided. You know, they say if you're really serious about getting abortion numbers down, you should fund contraception programs. But most contraception programs are not all that effective.
Oh, I see. That's the point.
Activity.
It's not laws that lower the number of abortions. It's contraception.
They're absolutely wrong.
But you make the point. You say, look at the American abortion rate from the time of Roe.
Right.
How does that track?
Well, yeah, abortions jumped pretty significantly. I mean, after Roe was decided in 1973, you know, January of that year, 1974 was the first year where abortion was legal for a full calendar year. If you compare 1974 to 1980, the abortion rate in the U.S. jumped by 50%. Now, prior to Roe, abortion was legal, but only in certain states. It was legal in New York, California, and a handful of other states. Roe v. Wade made it legal, throughout the entire country. Again, in the 6 years, 7 years after Roe v. Wade, abortion rates in the U.S. jump up by 50%. You know, there's some evidence that there was gain in public support for legal abortion after Roe. Abortion facilities started opening up in just about every state. The economic cost of obtaining an abortion went down, and it comes as no surprise that abortion is more easily available, less expensive. Abortion numbers go up.
Well, how do these spin doctors explain the, I think, a rather dramatic lowering of the number of abortions in the United States over the last, say, decade?
Yeah, we've seen it made very good progress, and I think it's progress the pro-life movement should frankly do a better job claiming credit for. We've seen the rates peak in 1980, and the abortion rate's fallen pretty consistently just about every year since then. I think 2014 is the most recent year for which we have data. Between 1980 and 2014, the abortion rate's fallen by half. In fact, the abortion rate in 2014 is actually lower than it was in 1973 when Roe v. Wade was decided.
And wait a minute. Pause there for a second, Michael. I'm talking to Dr. Michael New. I mean, that's a huge statistic, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What you just said.
Yeah, the abortion numbers are falling, and again, it's actually, according to the latest data, the numbers are slightly lower than where they were in 1973. So it's taken a while, but we have made some real progress.
Well, that's more than real progress, isn't it? It's, I mean, to take it back to the number that we had at the moment of Roe versus Wade when we saw this, you know, huge increase in abortion, to get back to that point, I'd say that's a huge achievement. And what would the spin doctors blame that on? Would they say it's contraception?
Oh, they're very eager to credit contraception, but there's really not much evidence suggesting it's contraception. That one important statistic to look at is the unintended pregnancy rate. And the unintended pregnancy rate has been pretty stable since 1980. There's some evidence it dropped a little bit starting in around 2010. But by and large, if you look at the years between, say, 1980 and 2010, it went down by a little bit, but it did not go down by much. It's really important to know that, you know, unintended pregnancies are still happening. What has changed, which is very hopeful, is that a higher percentage of unintended pregnancies are being carried to term. And you know, we have that information from actually Guttmacher. They don't necessarily trumpet this, but the data is real. I think in the early 90s, about 40% were carried to term, and that number up to about 54% by 2008. So you have more and more women are in fact choosing life and carrying those pregnancies to term.
But you find, I read in another column of yours, Michael, about the way in which abortion reporting ignores the medical dangers to women, that they tend to completely over, how should I say, overemphasize the safeness of having an abortion.
Mm. Right. I think that, again, reporting standards are weak, and the abortion industry wants to promote this fiction that abortion's safe. And essentially, I think very often if something does go wrong during an abortion procedure, there's all kinds of rules. Like, for instance, I don't think the abortionist necessarily has to, transport the woman in an ambulance. Sometimes he'll be in a private vehicle. They'll probably find a physician who's sympathetic who may cover up and, list some other cause of death or some other cause of injury. Again, the report requirements on abortion injuries and fatalities are pretty weak. The abortion industry has a real incentive to, perpetuate this fiction that abortion is safe. And again, they typically will transport injured women to sympathetic physicians who may list some other cause for injury or cause of death.
And so is this another intentional act of cherry-picking statistics by Guttmacher?
Yeah, I think so. Again, the reporting requirements are just not terribly strong. And, essentially, also when you look at some of the other health risks, it's very tough to get things published in academic journals. Journal editors are on liberal campuses. They don't want to deal with unhappy colleagues or at either their school or other schools. And if the academic papers come along, which do show that abortion poses health risks, they'll find reasons to reject them, usually frivolous ones. So as a researcher...
Well, that puts you as a scholar in a very frustrating position, doesn't it?
Yeah,
I mean, you're a serious scholar, a serious record of publication, of speech, of speaking. You have great authority in this area as much as anybody I know in the United States. It must be very frustrating for you to meet with this kind of prejudice in the academic world.
Yeah, it is frustrating. I mean, essentially, one thing I always tell myself is that if the data back you up, you will win, but there's an important corollary. Winning can take a long time. So and sometimes, again, you just need to find ways to publish. Sometimes I've noticed that foreign journals are sometimes a little bit more willing to publish these studies than U.S. journals. In some foreign countries, the pro-life movement is weaker, and they just don't really feel that there'll be much of a backlash as a result from colleagues or peers or friends if they do publish these studies. And sometimes, we just have to work hard against entrenched positions. I mean, for a long time, cigarette companies tried very hard to dismiss scholarship that showed that there are health risks to smoking. But just over time, the evidence just became so overwhelming that, we had to admit that, or they had to admit that.
So you do publish statistics that provide bad news for the pro-life movement.
Well, no, I'm talking about, I think I've presented statistics to show bad news for our opponents.
What happens when you find that your statistics have, it's bad news for our side?
I try to provide some context. I mean, it doesn't necessarily stop me from publishing articles. For instance, not every kind of pro-life law is effective necessarily.
Right.
I don't necessarily find that standalone waiting periods by themselves have had a big impact on abortion rates. I don't necessarily think the legal weight of the 90s-era partial birth abortion bans have had much of an impact. I do think that framed the discussion and framed the debate in ways that were helpful, but I'm not sure that the legal force of the laws that various states passed had much of an impact. I think you just have to be honest. I think that you really try to do good, credible scholarship, and if there are certain policy goals or strategies that are ineffective, it's not necessarily by itself the end of the world. Laws can serve different purposes. They can, change opinion. They can, lead to other incremental gains down the road. I think it's just in everybody's best interest to be honest about what they find.
Well, sometimes, I have found that grassroots activists, they don't want to hear that their favorite strategy isn't working.
Right.
They want to believe that whatever strategy has gotten the activists themselves all worked up is necessarily working among those that need to be converted.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I'll just say is that, you know, number one, you should never put too much weight on any one study. I mean, sometimes, you know, numbers sometimes just click out in ways that we don't expect. And, you know, I never look at any study as a be-all and end-all. You know, I try to look for a consensus in the kind of the academic literature. And I think another thing to remember is that, you know, people, if you really only have one strategy to end abortion, you're probably not perceiving this issue the right way. When I talk to pro-life audiences, you know, I always say that, you know, we have to have all hands on deck. That it's not going to be any one thing, it's going to be many things. We need people running for office. We need people praying. We need people sidewalk counseling. We need people donating and working for pregnancy resource centers. We're kind of fighting this on a lot of different levels, kind of political, cultural, spiritual, and we need all hands on deck. So, you know, if you believe you have the one magic strategy to end abortion, chances are I think you're wrong. I think we need to fight this on as many fronts as possible, and I think everybody has a job to do with. Thankfully, everybody can play a role.
Well, I think you're exactly right. In other words, some people will respond to what is the often criticized, like Father Pavone's strategy of showing the destruction of the fetus, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Some people who need to see that won't see it. They'll turn their head. So there's there's room for a more indirect and sort of calmer approach to it. So I think that, you know, it's a mistake to say that the only way you can do pro-life work is this way or that way, because different people are touched by different strategies. Is that what you find?
Definitely. I think that, you know, different approaches kind of work well for different people. You know, the different kinds of arguments might make sense for different, in front of different audiences. Again, I think that this is a multi-pronged battle. I think that, you know, we have to change the culture, but I think we have to get good people elected. We need good judges confirmed. We need to gain public support. We need to help women who face unintended pregnancies. Again, there's just, you know, a lot of different things, you know, to do, and you know, everyone can do something, you know, whether it's just prayer, making a donation. It's a small donation. Sometimes a little can go a long way. So, again, I think everybody has an important role to play, and this is an important calling, and I always encourage local activists that all hands need to be on deck.
In your career as someone who has tracked these issues, the abortion issue in particular, statistic has most surprised you that you weren't expecting?
The one thing that I think is important, and it's a statistic that pro-lifers should probably, well, there's two things I would say, if you'll give me two. One is that the gains in unintended pregnancy being carried to term. Yeah, that's a very good statistic. The fact that more women who get pregnant unexpectedly or didn't intend to get pregnant are going ahead and carrying the pregnancy to term, that really shows that pro-lifers are having an impact. Now, that impact might be through legislation. It might be through meeting the needs of women through pregnancy resource centers. It might mean we're just changing hearts and minds, shifting public opinion. But that statistic really does show that pro-life efforts are making a difference. That's one thing. The second statistic that's interesting that I often talk about is that we're actually making some pretty impressive gains in public opinion among young people, which is exciting. That many polls in the 70s and 80s showed a big generation gap on the abortion issue, where young people were very sympathetic toward legal abortion, and senior citizens were very pro-life. And this worried a lot of pro-life activists. They were afraid that an older, more pro-life generation would just die off and be replaced by people who were sympathetic to legal abortion. But that really didn't happen. That every year, every 2 years, there's a group called the General Social Survey that does very comprehensive public opinion polling. They collect a lot of demographic data. They ask people about a whole range of issues. And one of the issues they ask about is abortion. And they ask about six different abortion questions, trying to measure people's opinion on this issue. And again, in the 70s and 80s, you know, they found that young adults were the quote-unquote most pro-choice. But as of 2000, that kind of flipped. According to their surveys, young people are actually more pro-life, even more pro-life than senior citizens. So we've really seen a real kind of changing of the tide with how young people are viewing this issue.
And also, I guess, how young women are viewing the feminist message. Would that be right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that you had one generation of women that was very feminist. I think very often Perhaps they had mothers or older relatives who, didn't have, some of the opportunities their daughters had, and, they were, very ambitious professionally, as a result. And, I think that, a lot of, women, kind of sour on feminism. I think that, I think that they, really are starting to value things like, family a bit more, marriage a bit more than perhaps they used to. And I think that's, kind of shifting, sentiment in a more pro-life direction.
Well, I think, there's this, what they call third wave feminism, which our mutual friend, I think Marjorie Dannenfeltzer, and others represent, which doesn't center on abortion. In fact, it's centered on pro-life, with women being appreciated for their unique role in creation, as it were, and in the family.
Yeah, absolutely. That one thing that's happened, I remember talking to some people. I was in college in the 90s, and we had very few women were really involved in right-of-center political groups. And I would just ask people, what do you think would get more women involved? And one answer I got from a couple people is that we really need a woman to run for the Republican nomination for president. There are more kind of, women who are a little bit younger, who are pro-life and conservative, that would really get more women involved. And since the 90s, we've seen a lot of very, prominent pro-life women emerge. We've seen Marjorie, of course. We've seen Michelle Bachmann. We've seen Sarah Palin. We've seen many others.
Kellyanne Conway, of course.
Kellyanne Conway, of course. We just had the SPLS gala a couple nights ago. So I think that all of a sudden you see kind of a lot of successful professional women who are Catholic or Christian, who are pro-life and very outspoken about their pro-life views. And I think they're kind of creating, they're a great bunch of role models for this coming generation of young women.
We're going to talk more with Dr. Michael New about abortion and related cultural social matters after this short break.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is made possible in part by a gift made from our day sponsor, Mrs. Ann Ward, in remembrance of Father Leo Locu, on the fifth anniversary of his death. You serve your people with love and devotion. You are missed by all those whom you touched.
Hello, I'm Father Michael Sui, pastor of St. Louis de Marillac Parish in Warren. June 3rd through June 5th, we are having our parish mission. We lovingly invite all of you to join us. Two powerful evangelists, Peter Herbeck from Fire on the Earth and his wife Debbie, will lead us by the power of the Holy Spirit and the love of Jesus. Join us as we unleash the gospel in the Archdiocese of Detroit. Remember, June 3rd through June 5th at 6:30 p.m., for more information, go to stlouisedm.org.
Are you tired of how your faith is represented in the mainstream media? Stop getting your Catholic news from secular sources and get it from a trusted local Catholic source instead. At the Michigan Catholic Newspaper, we're Catholic, and we cover your Catholic Church in a way that only Catholics could. So the same reason you listen to Ave Maria Radio, get the Michigan Catholic for only $24 a year by calling 313-224-8000 or visit themichigancatholic.org.
The first 5 years of marriage can be a roller coaster. Regardless of how long you and your spouse knew each other before the big day, marriage changes everything. For better, or sometimes for worse. Hi, I'm Dr. Greg Popchak.
And I'm Lisa Popchak. If you're a newlywed or someone you love is getting married, check out our book, Just Married, A Catholic Guide to Surviving and Thriving in the First 5 Years of Marriage. You can find it on the online store at AveMariaRadio.net.
With Dr. Michael New, who, as I said at the top of the hour, Associate Professor of Economics at Ave Maria University, and is often seen on at National Review Online at the corner, blogging on issues regarding social conservatism and, of course, what we're talking about today, abortion. We're talking, Michael, on the eve of the Irish abortion referendum. Now, I'm not asking you to be a pundit and trying to predict what will happen. Why don't I begin by asking you, what do you think is at stake in that referendum?
I think quite lots at stake. That right now, Ireland is probably one of maybe six or seven developed countries that really have significant protections for the unborn. And those protections for the unborn are actually right in the Irish Constitution. And interestingly, what doesn't get much attention is that health outcomes in Ireland are very good. You know, they have a very low maternal mortality rate. You know, they have very low rates of complication after pregnancy. These are statistics that, frankly, I think pro-lifers probably could do a better job getting the word out about. And again, we have a lot of countries around the world that do protect the unborn, but not many industrialized democracies. And again, Ireland's one of very few, and those protections are jeopardized by this referendum vote that's taking place Friday.
Well, you know, Michael, in preparation for our conversation, I went and read the media was saying about the referendum, and I went through, I couldn't find a single major media outlet that said anything neutral about the referendum. They were all in the corner of the pro aborts. And they were all, you know, they're all lofty and high about how this is going to, you know, free the Irish culture and be, you know, the best thing that ever happened to Ireland, etc. And it is, you say, let's get the word out. But the question is, how do you get the word out when there's no media platform to get it out on?
It's very tough. I mean, one good development is that, you know, today that we don't have, didn't have 20, 30 years ago, is that, you know, well, it's 20 years ago we had it, but the internet is a great way to communicate with people. And, the mainstream media isn't quite the gatekeeper it used to be. That you can get pro-life commentary, you know, on websites like Life News, LifeSite News, places like National Review Online, do get the opinions of pro-life thinkers and analysts out there. You know, it's good to try to penetrate the mainstream media. You know, we shouldn't give up. But we also have to know it's tough. But and sometimes, informing our own side can be a good thing. And sometimes, you know, links of, you know, pro-life publications do get picked up and circulated. So, you know, we should just kind of use the tools that we have to, you know, make the best arguments we can and, disseminate the best research that we can.
Yeah. And so do you have any sense of how it may go?
Well, I mean, most of the polls seem to indicate that most people in Ireland, or at least a plurality, favor repealing the Eighth Amendment. And again, the Eighth Amendment is what does put legal protection for the unborn in the Irish Constitution. But it's not necessarily a majority yet, and there's a lot of people undecided. You know, I think it'll be undecided voters that are going to end up making a difference. One thing I will say we know about polling is that when you're dealing with kind of sensitive morality policy issues, a lot of people will tell pollsters what they believe to be the quote-unquote kind of socially acceptable position, but in the privacy of the voting booth, do something else.
So you, well, we certainly saw that with the Trump election, didn't we?
Oh, yep, absolutely. The pollsters got that completely wrong. We saw that with Brexit as well in Great Britain. Again, you know, I don't like to make predictions. The one prediction I make is that people who make predictions often get the egg on their face. But again, I really appreciate the good work that pro-life groups are doing in Ireland. You know, it's not a lost cause. And that even though they may be behind in the polls, we've seen more than our share of election surprises. So our thoughts and prayers are with the folks in Ireland right now.
Well, we certainly don't know what's going on internally in Ireland regarding this on the ground, among the grassroots, because the media is treating it like, you know, the day before the 2017 presidential election in the United States, when they absolutely were 100% sure that Hillary Clinton would win. So we don't know.
Right. You know, again, pollsters, you know, don't have a perfect track record. And I would say their track record tends to be a lot weaker when they're dealing with, again, sorts of issues where people may find social pressure to say one thing but do another.
You know, a parallel development is what's going on in Poland and the abortion law there. You know, you have this new government which has declared itself a Catholic government in Poland. and they have declared their intention of protecting the Catholic traditions and culture and fabric of Poland, and that does not fit very well with the European Union.
Right.
I mean, can you just talk a little bit about what you know about the way in which the European Union has tried to force abortion on other countries?
I mean, I'm not really familiar with a lot of the nuances, but again, lots of international bodies, whether it be the UN or the European Union, have a very strong pro-abortion agenda. They can try to make things difficult for member countries that don't toe that line. And, you know, Poland's a country with a very strong Catholic tradition. It is one of the few democracies where abortion is restricted. It's not completely illegal, but there are substantial protections of the unborn that are in place, and relatively few abortions happen there. And I think Poland is the kind of country that, frankly, is not going to be bullied by their national bureaucrats. I think that you know, they feel very strongly. They're a very Catholic country. They like their laws the way they are, by and large. And I think they'll stand firm against outside pressure to change their laws.
Are there any other countries in Europe, in the European Union, that where abortion is illegal?
That's a good question. I don't know if Malta is in the European Union or not. Malta is another country where abortion is illegal.
What about Italy?
Italy, I think, is legal up to the first trimester, sadly. I mean, you'd think a country like that with such a strong Catholic tradition would have better laws in place. They might be better than some countries, but it's still sad to see a country like that legalize abortion through the first trimester.
Now, we had some interesting legislation in the state of South Carolina recently, didn't we, regarding abortion?
Yep.
Tell our listeners about that if they didn't hear about it.
Refresh my memory, deal, which there's a lot of laws being passed, and which specific law are you referring to?
Didn't they pass a 20-week abortion bill in South Carolina?
Yeah, we've seen South Carolina do that. We've seen, actually, Iowa's really kind of been the one pushing the envelope on that heartbeat ban. Where they basically said that, you know, once a heartbeat can be detected, that, you know, abortion is no longer legal. That'll be certainly challenged in court.
By the way, I'll correct myself. I had been following a story in South Carolina about a bill that would have outlawed most abortions in South Carolina. But on May 4th, and I was in Italy, so I'll forgive myself for that, that bill was defeated in the Senate of South Carolina by 24-21.
Wow.
So even though they do have the bill we're talking about, which is the 20-week, what's the right word for that bill? What's the right description of the 20-week abortion ban?
The pain-capable abortion ban.
Right. It has to do when the fetus feels pain, correct?
Yeah, there's good medical evidence. And even the Chronicle of Higher Education, which is certainly not a conservative publication at all, even did a pretty fair story on this. And they did interview a lot of people who are interested, who study embryology, who are very credible, who did testify that even though they're not pro-life or involved in the pro-life movement, you know, they do feel the unborn can feel pain at 20 weeks.
Now, that has been a very successful national effort, I think, of pro-lifers to really, that's got to be partly responsible for lowering the number of abortions. I think, what are we up to, 15 or 16 states have that?
Yeah, I mean, relatively few abortions take place after 20 weeks, but it's good incrementally. I know a lot of pro-lifers are frustrated. Sometimes people think we should do more faster, but if you just look at kind of history of social movements, progress typically happens incrementally. One of the first big gains of the civil rights movement, or one of the first victories, was getting law schools desegregated. And I think they thought that was something they had a chance to win because they thought judges would be sympathetic to African Americans who wanted to attend a good law school. And that helped train a generation of civil rights lawyers, and they made a lot of gains after that. So, again, lots of times progress takes place incrementally. We see a lot of these states passing these 20-week bans. And interestingly, a lot of them are not being challenged in court. Usually, any time a pro-life law is enacted, there's a legal challenge almost instantaneously. But with these 20-week bans, we really don't see that in many cases. I think the other side's concerned that if it does make it to the Supreme Court, we will get a favorable ruling, and they prefer for that not to happen. So it's interesting watching our opponents on this.
What would then be the next step? I mean, would there be a legislative step that would logically follow from this one?
I think that it's kind of hard to say exactly what happened. I think, you know, 20 weeks is an incremental step. Again, it may not stop a lot of abortions, but it's framing the debate in a way that's helpful. That, you know, very few Americans think abortion should be, late-term abortion should be legal. So, again, sometimes framing the debate is helpful. I do think the debate over the partial birth abortion ban in the 90s was very useful to the pro-life movement. You know, we had actually pictures of abortion children, you know, on TV and newspapers and magazines. And, you know, people really don't realize how permissive our laws really are, and that this should public opinion in a useful direction. I think that we just keep trying to get more and more protection to the unborn, that after 20 weeks we might be able to try 15. I think Mississippi's already done that. I think that's being challenged in court. But, again, I think we just kind of work incrementally, and hopefully we reach a day where all unborn children are legally protected.
Now, I want to ask you, you are, as a blogger at the National Review, you're in touch with a lot with people who were not supportive of President Trump, and they have their reasons. But are they surprised, are you surprised by what President Trump has done on the life issue?
Honestly, a little bit. You know, I think a lot of us, we vote for Donald Trump, those of us who vote for Donald Trump, took a leap of faith. I mean, he wasn't until he ran for president that he identified as pro-life. That, so far as I could see, he had never lent his fame or his fortune or his prestige toward helping pro-lifers in any way before he became president. So it was a little bit of a leap of faith. But by all accounts, I think pro-life people should be, you know, very happy that he's been a very actually articulate spokesperson for life issues. The administration has done a lot of good things, like restoring and even strengthening the Mexico City policy. That's been an important win for us. So I think when he looked at the judicial appointments, that by and large are very good. You know, getting Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court was a big win. So I think pro-lifers should be happy with what they're getting from a policy perspective from the Trump administration.
Well, Michael, between you and me, I was at the Susan B. Anthony dinner the other night where you and I spoke and talked about, you know, having this interview. And I was at a table with someone who publicly was opposed to, very publicly opposed to Donald Trump during the campaign. And even though she was very appreciative of the, what you might call the, all the great things President Trump has done, she was still making her kind of, not scorns, too strong a word, but disapproval of President Trump, very evident. At the same time, she was clapping and yelling for, you know, all the good things he had done. Mm-hmm. And is that, and I'm not asking you to name anybody, but I'm just asking you, do you think that's a general disposition that many social conservatives, pro-lifers have of Trump? It's sort of like, we're really glad for what you're doing, but we still don't really like you very much.
I don't know. It's sort of hard to say. I mean, different people kind of view Donald Trump in different ways. I think that groups that really are kind of very heavily involved and heavily invested in policy from a day-to-day way, like Susan B. Anthony list, I think are happy and supportive and on board. Some conservatives that, you know, are kind of more thought leaders, but really not necessarily doing day-to-day policy work, so it can be a little more detached. You know, I think from a policy perspective, you know, everybody, I think, who's pro-life ought to be happy with this administration. I would say they probably have done more than any other Republican administration in my lifetime as far as good work on the pro-life issue. Now, not everybody likes President Trump's personal style. Not everybody likes how he uses Twitter. You know, he's done certain things in his personal life that I'm sure many of us, you know, don't agree with or even don't find reputable. But, you know, if you look at the policy things he's doing, there's a lot of reasons to be happy.
Yeah, I mean, the same person asked me at the dinner to explain why I supported Trump as early as I did in February, in mid-February of the campaign. And I won't go into it, but one thing I did mention was that I thought that in order to beat Hillary Clinton and to actually get change, it needed to be somebody with a skin as thick and maybe as brash a personality as a Donald Trump.
Yeah, there's something to be said for that. The people, Republican nominees, keep in mind, a lot of people don't pay a lot of attention to politics. Lots of would-be presidential candidates aren't really known well outside the Beltway or outside their own state. And I think that makes it very easy for the media to caricature them. Someone like Mitt Romney, who I think is a perfectly reputable person and somebody I was pleased to vote for, who I think would have done a good job, was just kind of demonized and caricatured as a touch plutocrat. But you can't really do that with Donald Trump. I mean, everybody knew who Donald Trump was. He had a reputation. He's a thick-skinned. People kind of know his character. They're not necessarily going to find anything about him they probably didn't already know or didn't already suspect. And, yeah, I think to some extent your argument makes sense. You need kind of a blunt, brash person who wasn't afraid of media criticism, who couldn't easily be who was well-known. And sometimes it may take that kind of person to enact or adopt real change.
Yeah, and when you look at, you and I have both been in this game a long time, and we've seen Republican presidents like George W. Bush come along, and they did good things. But when it comes to, like, defunding Planned Parenthood, they wouldn't touch it.
No, wouldn't keep in mind, Republicans took control of Congress in 1994. I was in college at the time, and that was a huge deal. I mean, Republicans have been in the minority in Congress for 40 years. And I think we were all like, the day after, if those of us who were conservative were like, kids at the candy store the next day. But the issue of defunding Planned Parenthood never even came up in the 90s. It was just off the table altogether. No one talked about it. No one mentioned it. In the 2000s, yeah, it got a little bit of attention, but a lot of Republicans voted against it. Now, by and large, with a few exceptions, just about every Republican office holder votes for the defunding of Planned Parenthood. We've really made some real ground there. So essentially, the other Republican presidents have done some good, and we appreciate that. But we're seeing some gains here that we have not seen for a long time.
And it's really because of Trump's leadership, his brashness, his sort of to hell with it attitude, I think is precisely what enabled some of the more moderate Republicans to get behind it. Sometimes you got to have a downfield blocker who just knocks people out of the way so you can start running, right?
Yeah, I agree.
So where do we go from here? I'm talking to Dr. Michael New, is, if not the leading, one of the leading social scientific commentators on abortion, an expert in abortion statistics and their impact on public policy. What would you like to see happen next?
Well, let's see. It's several things. I mean, I think, number one, we really have to keep working to defund Planned Parenthood. President Trump did strip the Title X funding from them.
That's about $60 million of a half a billion.
Well, it's not what we want, but it's an incorrect.
It's a start. It's symbolically hugely important, don't you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think that, again, this didn't happen in the Bush administration. I think that Reagan did try this at the very end of his term, but his presidency ended, and I'm not sure the funding cuts ever really took effect. So it's a good incremental step. I mean, one thing I always tell people is that big abortion needs a big government, and if you can defund Planned Parenthood, you'll do a lot of good. We've seen abortion rates fall since 1980, and there's a lot of reasons for that. One big reason is that's because the Supreme Court upheld the Hyde Amendment, which places pretty strict limits on the ability of federal funds to pay for abortion. So that cut off a lot of federal revenue to Planned Parenthood and other abortion facilities. So I think that's important. And we'll have to see about the Supreme Court. I don't know if Justice Kennedy or anybody else will resign. I think that if there's a confirmation hearing, it's going to be very contentious. I joked to my friends here in Washington that we all probably need to show up at work wearing helmets if that happens. But it's something we do need to prepare for. And if we do get a good nominee on the Supreme Court to replace Kennedy, we may succeed in overturning Roe. And if we don't, we can still get an outcome that lets us do more to protect the unborn at the state level. So, again, we need to keep fighting this on as many fronts as we can. Legislation, donations, supporting pregnancy resource centers, prayer, it all plays a role.
Let me ask you this question. Let's hypotheticalize, that's not a word, but I'll use it anyway. All of a sudden, Justice Kennedy steps down, retires, and there's a fight about confirmation. Mm-hmm. Let's say that social conservatives get somebody they like. Mm-hmm. Is our side ready immediately to launch some sort of court suit against Roe versus Wade and get it to the Supreme Court as quickly as possible?
That's a good question. Obviously, there's a lot of states doing a lot of good things, and there's lots of ongoing litigation. Keep in mind, there's a lot of things we don't really control. Obviously, we don't directly control court retirements. We don't control really who the replacement will be, though I think we have some influence. But we also don't control what cases the Supreme Court decides to take. You know, many, many cases are appealed to the Supreme Court. You know, they take a fraction of those. You know, I think the ballpark figure is maybe around 10% of cases that appeal to the Supreme Court are actually heard. What the best case is, what the best legal strategy is, you know, I'm not a lawyer, and, you know, that's beyond my expertise.
But you hang out with lawyers.
True. I do think that the kind of pink capable bills are a strong case. Partly because it's incremental, and also partly because the fact that the unborn can feel pain, we have evidence of that, that does create kind of an additional kind of compelling state interest to protect the unborn. And some people think that judges might find that very persuasive. Is that the best strategy? Again, I'm not sure, but I've heard a lot of people say that might be a good strategy to follow. But again, there's some things we can't control, some things we can't. We need to kind of do our due diligence when there is a vacancy, make sure we get the best nominee possible, get them confirmed, and again, legally, I just need to think very critically about the best kind of case to put before the court or to appeal to the court. The Supreme Court's probably not going to be reconsidering Roe v. Wade every year. Since 1973, they've really only reconsidered Roe v. Wade once in the Casey decision. And unfortunately, we didn't get the outcome we were hoping for. Hopefully, I think we've learned a bit from that that decision, and we'll be poised to make some strong legal challenges to Roe in the future.
So our listeners who are interested in following your work, your writing on this and other issues, how can they find you?
Well, the best way to find me is you can follow me on Twitter. That I do tweet out pro-life research and commentary just about every day. My Twitter handle is Michael_J_new. That's again, Michael_J_new.
What's J stand for?
Jason.
Okay. Michael J. New at?
Well, that's just my Twitter handle. So it's at Michael_J_new.
So those of you that don't know Twitter, you go to Twitter and you put in the at sign and then you write Michael_J_new. And that's how you find Dr. New on Twitter. What else should they do?
Also, they should definitely follow Susan B. Anthony Liston, the Lozier Institute, that when I do commentaries and writings, they do circulate them online. They do post them on the website. The Susan B. Anthony List website is sbalist.org, and Lozier Institute is spelled L-O-Z-I-E-R, institute.org. Commentary is often posted there. And, you know, those are, again, I would always encourage people to read National Review online. That's where all my writing and blogging comes up. And, you know, they do a good job circulating my pieces as well.
And once again, Dr. Michael New is an associate professor of economics. Quickly, explain why you're a professor of economics.
I was hired by Ave Maria in the summer of 2015. My PhD is actually in political science,
right.
But the kind of political science I studied was very quantitative. I was at Stanford. It was a very quantitative program where we use kind of economic models to predict political behavior. The politics department at Ave Maria tends to do a lot of work in political theory and political philosophy, and you know, they do some very good work there. That's not exactly what I do. You know, I do quantitative empirical research. It just made more sense to put me in the economics department at Ave Maria, and it was just a better fit for me.
Well, Ave Maria is very lucky to have you, Dr. Michael New. I appreciate your being a guest for the first time on Church and Culture, and hope you'll come back soon.
Sure, I'd love to.
Thank you. And to all of you who are listening, we'll have a short break and then another great guest.